Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. 25,000 journalists and broadcasters from more than 200 countries are in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, covering the Olympics. So what stands out for you in the coverage? Media outlets around the globe are being condemned for sexist coverage. There are also stories about Brazil's economic crisis, conflicting reports about violence against visitors, and many, many pieces about poverty in Rio and the 70,000 people who were displaced for the Games. Joining us to discuss coverage is Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Before taking that post in 2005, Kevin was the Brazil-based South America bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He is covering the Olympics, and his latest piece is called Judo Champ's Journey Shines Light on Afro-Brazilian Plight. And Kevin joins us from Rio. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me from far away.
Great to have you from far away. And we're also joined by Lee Fong, investigative journalist with The Intercept. Lee covers the intersection of money and politics, and he and his colleague John Schwartz worked on a four-part investigation about foreign corporate influence in U.S. presidential politics. As a result of their investigation, FEC Commissioner Anne Ravel is now calling for a ban on foreign money in politics. And Lee joins us in studio. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rose.
Great investigation.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. Lee, I know you just got back from vacation, but what are you seeing right now that really stands out for you?
Well, hands down, the best investigative piece this week was the New York Times multi-part, two-part series on think tank corruption, taking a look at the most prominent academic think tanks in Washington, D.C. that are very politically active, and finding that not only, it's well known that they receive lots of corporate donations and that sometimes their agendas or missions align very closely with their corporate donors, but this piece really delved deeply into showing that many of the actual scholars and fellows and leadership of these think tanks are simultaneously lobbyists, and that they use their positions at the think tanks to advance the lobbying priorities for their clients, from drone makers to real estate developers and banks. I mean, the piece has so many interesting anecdotes. So really worth reading that from Eric Lipton and Brooke Williams at the New York Times.
And this, and San Francisco is in that piece because there's a connection between Brookings and the Lennar Corporation. This is the company that is behind the big development in the Bayview.
Yeah, that's one of the more interesting anecdotes in the piece.
I'm so glad you brought that up. KQED's Forum actually had a piece about that this morning, and we are going to cover that next Friday because the media angle is that all of these think tanks, people who work for these think tanks are on radio shows, they're on television, they write op-eds on a daily basis, and it's not only are the hosts not saying who are your clients, but they rarely talk about the funding of these think tanks. They just introduce the person and the name of the think tank, and that's about it.
Yeah, that's right. And then one interesting kind of angle to the story is that even the New York Times that uncovered this, look back at New York Times coverage. They are, you know, on a weekly basis, cite these think tanks in their stories as the most credible source available.
Right.
So, I mean, hopefully this piece will really kind of change media coverage going forward. Although no fingers crossed.
Well, maybe. We're going to cover that next week's media roundtable. Kevin, did you see that piece?
I did not. I'm focused on things further south.
Well, how does McClatchy deal with think tanks when you quote someone who works at a think tank?
Yeah, I suspect we're guilty somewhat of the same problem, but I think you're in Washington long enough, you kind of know, for lack of a better word, who's a hack and who's kind of really more kind of research-oriented. For instance, there's certain people at AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, who I will interview, and there's others I won't. You kind of make that call as a journalist as to whether you think someone's credible or has a position or an axe to push. Mm. And the same with Brookings or any of the others. And many of the think tanks, you know, have particular views, like the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities and things of that sort. So we try to identify them as centrist or center-left, or we try to give the reader some indication of, at least, you know, from a political standpoint. But in terms of who their donors are, less so. But we don't, you know, we wouldn't do a piece narrowly on something that they're pushing.
Well, we will link to that story right after the show at yourcallradio.org. And Kevin, what about you? What caught your eye this week?
Well, I've, again, been kind of narrowly focused here, so I suspect some of what caught my eye would be of less interest. But there was a story that we ran, and McClatchy and others ran as well, about in Argentina, the release of lots and lots of secret documents from the dictatorship, which shed new light on the not only the Kissinger role in promoting what had been the dirty wars in Latin America in the 70s and 80s, but also the conflict between the Carter administration that really made an effort to back away from these people and the folks tied to the Kissinger, for lack of a better word, the Kissinger group, people who were of like-minded thinking, and the degree to which they were continued to obfuscate or become be part of the problem while Carter tried to enforce human rights. So it's a bit of an old story in terms of time frame, but it's one that continues to shed new light on kind of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, and we saw that piece. We wanted to do a show about that. So thanks for bringing that one up, and we will also link to that right after the show. That is Kevin Hall. He's chief economics correspondent for McClatchy. He is in Rio de Janeiro covering the Olympics. He was the Brazil-based South America bureau chief for Knight Ridder before he took the McClatchy post in 2005. And Lee Fong is investigative journalist with The Intercept. He covers the intersection of money and politics. So, Kevin, you're in Rio covering the Olympics. 25,000 journalists from more than 200 countries are in Rio covering the Olympics. There's so many stories about the Olympics. What really stands out for you about what reporters are choosing to focus on?
Well, yeah, it's kind of humorous. My job is to be, we have a bunch of sports writers here, so my job is not to really be the sports writer, but to do the outside. So whether it's the crime issue or security or things of that sort. And I guess what stands out, particularly having lived here, is the degree to which perspective, you know, if you're an Argentine journalist, these things that the American press is writing about really don't stand out, because either, you know, the housing at the Olympic quarters is better than what 90% of the world has, so it doesn't jump out. The Australians made a big stink about the conditions, the lack of, you know, shower curtains with that weren't attached well, and things like that. So I think that it almost stood out as humorous, kind of the first world reaction, where 90% of the visiting journalists didn't bat an eye at those stories, American and European, really American and British stories. British crown countries really focused on some of the negatives.
And what about you, Lee? You've been gone, but the Olympics is getting a lot of attention. What really stands out for you?
I mean, I haven't really watched the games, so I might not be the best person to talk to about this. But just from a cursory glance at the media coverage, and I'm not just talking about lefty or independent media, but just mainstream coverage, stuff you see on television and from the major broadcasting networks and their websites, there's a big look at the structural problems in Brazil. I mean, I haven't seen really the political crisis being covered that Brazil is going through, but just looking at the poverty and the crime and the inequality and the squalor that kind of surrounds Rio, that's actually, it seems like a dominant theme of a lot of the media coverage. So that's been very interesting. That's not something that I've noticed in the past from other similar sporting events.
Yeah, Kevin, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, if you just search Olympics poverty, so much comes up. I mean, the New York Times, Beyond Olympics Glow, A Vicious Drug War Rages in Rio. National Geographic, There's a Dark History Behind the Glittering Olympic Games. The Guardian, Mike, Poverty in Rio. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. What explains this?
Yeah, well, I guess nobody's ever been here before, because certainly these stories have been written, you know, once a week for the last 20 years. It's certainly nothing of this is surprising or a new phenomenon. And, you know, the lack of knowledge, there was an example of a tragic example of that brought about 88,000 police and soldiers on the street from around the country just to, you know, provide a sense of security and just keep order. And one of them, unfortunately, was shot out near the airport in one of the more violent slums when he accidentally pulled his car into a favela, which is, anybody who's from Rio knows that's an absolute no-go. And if you're a trafficker and you see the police car coming in, you assume it's the start of a raid and you open fire. So it was a tragic event, but it was reported as if it had happened all around the tourists. And in fact, it happened in these very marginalized, one of the worst slums in the city, somewhere that no tourist would be near. And that kind of coverage, I think, gives a very misleading picture, whereas most of the events and most of the tourists are in places in Brazil that have always had street crime, you know, that somebody got their watch stolen or their purse stolen. That happens here all the time. That's not newsworthy.
So how do you think those issues should be covered for people who don't have much familiarity with the area?
Well, I mean, I think to a degree it speaks to our kind of innocence of lack of knowledge around the world. The other thing to keep in mind is most of the people here are sports writers, not regular reporters, so they may not have been exposed to this in a way that others, you know, who have worked in rough regions in the Middle East or here, you know, have seen that. So I think that's part of it. And I think there's the political story. We did the Lula story. One of the things that was most remarkable was the man who brought these games to Brazil, and they were given to Brazil in 2009 because Lula had, the president Lula had kind of shown that you can have a leftist leader who isn't going to chase business out, but you know, the economy was doing well, he had social programs, hunger and extreme poverty were really being eradicated. That's why Brazil got the game. It was kind of to spotlight all the accomplishments. Unfortunately, Brazil was in a two-year recession, deep political crisis. The former president faces has been indicted and faces two more investigations, and wasn't at the games, nor was his hand-picked successor, who is facing impeachment on September 12th. So there's a huge political backdrop to it. And I think the major major newspaper companies have covered it, but it's something that you don't feel that much in the day-to-day here.
Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He's joining us from Rio, talking about coverage of the Olympics. And it's getting wall-to-wall coverage. What do you make of all of the attention given to the Olympics? What stories are you seeing that stand out for you? And we did a show about the Olympics recently with Jules Boykoff. His new book is called Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at yourcallradio. We're also joined by Lee Fong, investigative journalist with The Intercept. We'll be talking to him about his piece about foreign corporate influence in U.S. presidential elections a little later in the show. Kevin, you have lived in Brazil. You speak the language. What stands out for you about how local reporters are covering the Olympics and these issues?
Yeah, I think the local handling, it's kind of curious because it must be what it's like for a foreigner in the U.S. to watch the Olympic coverage, because here on TV, you would think there were only Brazilians in the games, because that's all that you're seeing, you know, ping pong matches covered, you know, in their entirety live. So there's kind of a Homer kind of reporting in the TV. In terms of the security and things like that, I think the papers here have continued to do a really good job. They're the ones who broke the news about the head of security at the stadium where the opening event was held, actually being mugged or about to be mugged, and his security guy shot and killed the mugger. That came out of the Brazilian press. I think they've continued to report as they do every day. And I think the challenge is for a lot of us, how do you use the Olympics to kind of spotlight things like the race story that we ran today? You don't want to be negative, but you also want to kind of give people a window into the culture and a window into what's happening here. And I think that was the kind of story that really stood out, as the Rafaela Silva, the judo fighter, in 2012, when she came back from London, eliminated on a disqualification, had all kinds of horrible racial insults and thrown at her, and social media was just really cruel. And she won the gold medal, and suddenly people forgot that, and now suddenly, so it was kind of a teachable moment, for lack of a better word, that here in Brazil there was some soul searching going on about how she was treated, and now suddenly she's the star. But also, if you're not from here and you see TV, you see a very different reality than what you see out on the streets. There are still only white faces on TV, very few people of color on the TV. This is a country with at least 53% of the country black or mixed race. Yet you hardly see that on the television at all.
Yeah, I didn't know that, Kevin. And your piece, and we have it at Your Call Radio, Judo Champ's Journey Shines Light on Afro-Brazilian Plight. It's, again, about Rafaela Silva, a young woman, Afro-Brazilian. You write that this is really exposing the state of race relations in a country that has the largest number of African descendants outside of Africa. I didn't know that. I'm guessing that a lot of other people don't know that either. So can you tell us a little bit more about this? Brazil has the largest number of African descendants outside of Africa. You write that African Americans make up about 13% of the population here in the United States, 53% African or mixed race descendants comprise about 53% of the population, according to Brazil's most recent census data.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the simplest way, Brazil was the last country to get rid of slavery, but that doesn't tell the whole story. They were one in five slaves. Roughly 20% of all slaves came to Brazil, closer geographically and closer climatically. The U.S., if my memory of numbers is right, I think was in the ballpark of 500,000, and in Brazil, considerably more. So I think you have a large number to begin with, and then there's a real complex history in which Brazil, from its get-go, was considered a kind of a racial, post-racial society because it didn't make distinctions, but that didn't mean that there was equality. And I think to this day the issue is access to equality, and I think all the social indicators show that. And there hasn't been something like the Black Lives Matter movement here, partly because people who are the majority don't identify as a minority, for lack of a better, less elegant way to say it. So I think, but there is an awakening, and the numbers are what they are, and I think they're addressing that, starting to move aggressively to address that through affirmative action on income. It gets called racial quotas, but it's actually not racial quotas, it's income quotas, which disproportionately, find people of color.
And, Kevin, do you know what Rafaela Silva's plans are from here? You write that when she got back from London, so many people on social media said, and I don't even want to say what they called her because it's just so rude, she was really depressed. She thought about quitting, and now she won the gold in judo. Do you know what her plans are from here?
I don't. Personally, what I've read, I think right now it's they're still in kind of the gold medal go mode, that she's on every TV show and has become rapidly a national hero. So I suspect her future is probably, she already works with an institute to help other underprivileged people get out of the favelas and through sport. So I would expect to see more of that, and I suspect she'll be kind of a goodwill ambassador. There's a long tradition here of athletes who come from poorer backgrounds of creating institutes and mechanisms to help others up. So I think that's what I would expect.
Well, this is a great piece. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's Kevin Hall joining us from Rio de Janeiro, where he is covering the Olympics. Be sure to read the story he wrote about Rafaela Silva, the Afro-Brazilian from the infamous City of God slum. She just won the gold in judo, and you can find Kevin's story at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is The Intercept's Lee Fong. Lee covers money and politics. Lee and his colleague John Schwartz worked on a four-part investigation about foreign corporate influence in U.S. presidential politics. And as a result of their investigation, the Federal Election Commission Commissioner Ann Ravel is calling for a ban on foreign money in politics. Lee, because this election is just becomes even more surreal by the day because of Donald Trump, unfortunately, money in politics is not really getting the attention it deserves. Why did you and your colleague John Schwartz decide to focus specifically on foreign money in U.S. politics?
Well, this actually goes back to when the Citizens United decision was handed down in 2010, in January. The immediate reaction came from President Obama. Just a few days later at his State of the Union, he warned that this decision would open the floodgates to foreign corporate influence, that they would seize upon this decision. And also, I should note that in the dissent, this possibility was raised. So, you know, this has been an issue for 6 years now. And
when Obama said that, Justice Antonin Scalia said, no, it won't.
Oh, no, that was Alito, but yeah.
Alito, thank you.
Yeah, he said, that's a lie. I think he mouthed. Yeah. And, you know, for much of the media, PolitiFact said that Obama's wrong, and Republicans on Capitol Hill mocked President Obama. And many in the media dismissed this concern without really investigating it. So, you know, we decided to do something fairly simple. We simply looked at the largest corporate donations to the presidential super PACs in this election cycle and started investigating the ownership structure. And fortunate for us, we found that one of the largest corporate donors in the election cycle so far has a very clear they didn't try to hide the donation. You know, a lot of these companies use dark money groups or they set up phony companies, you know, LLCs in Delaware or Wyoming. But fortunately for us, this company used its real name and it has a clear document trail back showing the true ownership going back to Singapore to this Chinese couple. Gordon Tong and his wife Serena Chen own a large investment company investing primarily in real estate developments, and they gave a $1.3 million donation through their domestic subsidiary here in California to Right to Rise, this super PAC that was created to support Jeb Bush's presidential aspirations. So that's how we came upon this donation, and then a lot of the story is kind of twofold. One, it kind of proves for the very first time that President Obama was right, that here's a clear path for foreign influence in our presidential elections provided by the Citizens United decision. But also this story, as we kind of peeled back the layers of the onion, showed a lot more. You know, not only this wasn't an anomaly, the top or what many consider the top election attorney in the country for the Republicans, a man named Charlie Spies. He's helped advise George W. Bush, the Republican Governors Association. That's another big money group. He set up the massive super PAC supporting Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012. And he's, you know, advised a whole lot of other Republican candidates. We obtained a memo from him outlining all the rules that a foreign company has to follow if they would like to exploit the Citizens United decision to give money to American candidates. So, you know, this donation that we found, it's likely not the only one. It's certainly the easiest to identify because we found all these documents that clearly show the ownership structure. But it's probably not the only one because we found this memo, or we obtained this memo that shows that the very top Republican money men are soliciting foreign money, and that they've provided this roadmap for it to come into the election. And not only that, this story also just kind of shows that for this Chinese couple, Gordon Tong and his wife, they were very interested in winning American friends. So, you know, this donation was one aspect, but they hired a lobbyist in San Francisco. They gave donations throughout Oregon and California. You know, they flew out San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee to China twice to do these kind of real estate promotion events and sister city agreements. And they even got Gary Locke, the U.S. ambassador to China, very close to their business, buying his home in Bethesda, hiring him as an advisor. So this is a story of tremendous influence, but one pillar of that influence is campaign finance.
Well, we'll talk more after the break about who these people are, what they want in return, and their connections to San Francisco and California. Lee Fong is an investigative journalist with The Intercept. He and his colleague John Swartz worked on a four-part investigation about foreign corporate influence in U.S. presidential politics. An FEC commissioner is now calling for a ban on foreign money in politics, which speaks to the importance of journalism. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the growing influence private equity firms have on our daily lives. They now control water supplies, roads, transportation, garbage collection, and a lot more. According to a New York Times investigation, since the financial crash in 2008, private equity firms have expanded their influence by winning government contracts and shaping public policy. That is on Monday. And then in a related show, later in the week, we'll be joined by David Dayan, a journalist. He's out with a new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about money and politics, this is Lee Fong's specialty. And unfortunately, this issue is not really getting the attention it deserves because of the obsession with Donald Trump. But here are some numbers we need to know. The cost of this year's election is soaring to new heights. Some estimates peg it at almost $12 billion. $12 billion. That's up from about $10 billion in 2012. So this is, we're talking states, federal elections, $12 billion. Digital spending is set to reach $1 billion for the very first time, up from $159 million in 2012. So what are your thoughts about this? Money in politics is so, so important. We talk about it regularly here on the show. And Lee Fong, investigative journalist with The Intercept, does extensive reporting on this issue. And if you have any questions for Lee about reporting, give us a call at 866-798-8255. Okay, so Lee, let's stick first with your investigation before we talk more broadly. You told us about this couple from China, Gordon Tong and Serena Chen. They funneled $1.3 million into Jeb Bush's campaign. And you also said that they have connections to San Francisco and California. So how do you go about getting this information? Is it out there for anyone to read, or do you have to do a lot of digging?
We did a lot of digging, and I want to emphasize that I wrote this with John Swartz and really an amazing team at The Intercept. We worked with a number of fact-checkers and editors and a great freelancer, Elaine Yu, based in Hong Kong, who helped do a lot of this story. This story spanned, several continents. You know, this couple, invest heavily in real estate in Singapore, in Malaysia, in southern China, and over the last 7 years in the United States. So a lot of this was looking up real estate records, looking up corporate documents. Thankfully, they also, in addition to their private company that they used to make this donation, they have a fundraising vehicle in Singapore called the Singhai Group. And Singapore has a great financial system in terms of requiring a lot of disclosure. So we relied heavily on the Singapore Stock Exchange mandated financial disclosures. And of course, we looked also at a number of campaign finance documents, public statements, and we had conference calls and discussions with this company, talking to them while they're in Asia and in the United States.
All right. So, what do we need to know about this particular couple and why they're giving money to American politicians?
Well, according to Wilson Chen, the brother-in-law of Gordon Tong, he said that there was no quid pro quo, but they were very interested in pursuing what he equated to the Chinese tradition of gongcha, which is paying tribute, basically, that if you want to do business anywhere, you've got to go to the political leadership and make an offering. And that's very similar to how you do business here in the United States. So that's a very fair comparison. They were very aggressive in courting different high-level political friends. And as Wilson Chen also argued to me, real estate, which is their primary interest here in the United States, has a lot of red tape. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of regulations involved. There's lots of zoning and other rules that govern real estate development. So it doesn't hurt to have a lot of high-level friends, especially when they're doing these really massive deals. I mean, just to give you an example, after the financial collapse, they bought a tower in Portland for something like $50 million, reportedly. And they turned around and sold it for around $80 million. It's a big deal, made them a lot of money, reportedly. You see, as they were doing these complex real estate deals, they were also courting local politicians, making campaign donations, hiring law firms with a lot of political connections, retaining former American government officials as special advisors. It's really remarkable because it's very similar to what any American domestic firm you see doing these high-level deals. They also behave in similar ways.
Right. And we've done a show about foreign entities buying condos in San Francisco, for example, and not living in them. And that's starting to get a lot more attention. And people are calling on lawmakers to pass legislation to start dealing with this.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, this is potentially part of a larger influx as foreign buyers, particularly from China, see U.S. real estate as as something to speculate on, as a place to park their assets, especially given the kind of reports coming out of China. There's that there will be a larger crackdown in terms of taxes. They see the U.S. as actually a tax haven in certain respects. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that we will see more stories like this. Maybe not the same level of over $1 million campaign contributions to the presidential cycle, but in terms of political influence of buying and of hoping to win high-level political friends as these real estate deals are done.
Li Fong is an investigative journalist with The Intercept. We are talking about his four-part investigation about foreign corporate influence in presidential politics here in the U.S. FEC Commissioner Ann Revelle is calling for a ban on foreign money in politics. We have a few calls on the line. Callers, let's go to Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's kind of I was just kind of thinking about the fact that this real estate investor you're talking about has pretty much the same interest that an American real estate investor would have. And I don't know why we're making such a big deal about, foreign investment when the 1% in the United States is not going to be barred from making these kinds of investments. And I don't really see the difference if it's a Chinese investor investing in real estate and making sweetheart deals versus if it's, it's a local investor. I live in Oakland, and I'm seeing what's happening to the real estate market. And I know who these real estate investors are in Oakland, and they're not all Chinese. So what's the difference? Why don't we focus on the actual problem, which is money in politics, and not the 1% money in politics.
Hey Chris, I think the reason we did this story was not because of real estate and who's investing in it, but because of this by highlighting this kind of murky area in American law that has completely changed because of the Citizens United decision. No, we talk about the real estate side just because that explains their motivations, why they're getting involved in American politics. But the crux of our story, the focus of our story, is campaign finance. before the Citizens United decision, if you were a foreign corporation with business in the United States, there were so many rules you had to follow. Let's say you were Toyota or TransCanada. You had to have your domestic subsidiary set up a political action committee, and then there were rules. The foreign ownership could not – once that had been set up, they couldn't touch it. Only the American managers could touch that political action committee. And then once that political action committee was set up from Toyota or TransCanada or one of these other foreign firms, only American individuals, their employees, for example, could then donate to it, and a committee set up domestically could make decisions about it. So there were many firewalls. But then once the Citizens United decision happened and you see the elimination of the distinction between individuals, human beings that you could trace every single campaign dollar back to corporate entities, which are fictions of the state, that distinction kind of disappears. I mean, how do you realistically say that a 100% owned domestic subsidiary of a foreign corporation is making independent decisions of their, you know, that are completely disconnected from their foreign ownership? It seems impossible to enforce. And in this story, it highlights kind of the gray area, like, you know, for this old FEC rulemaking that sets up very, very clear parameters for how a foreign-owned domestic corporation can behave. Now, with the Citizens United decision saying that the actual domestic subsidiary on its own can make unlimited donations, the firewalls basically fade away.
And you also bring up another interesting point in the piece, and that is that so many of these corporations are now global. Right, these multinationals. So how does that complicate this issue? The most recent Treasury Department survey estimates that about $6 trillion in stock, or one quarter of the total market value of public U.S. corporations, is ultimately owned by foreign nationals.
That's right. I mean, there are so many paths for foreign influence that are very difficult to trace just because it's difficult to really understand the ownership of a lot of corporations. Now, for most public companies, publicly traded companies, you can look at some of the largest shareholders and figure out the ownership. But for a private company, there's really little disclosure. So you could have a legitimate domestic corporation. I mean, the legitimate as in it's got a real business. It's buying and selling things. It's providing a service. But then it could a foreign corporation could take it over. Buy shares or buy a large ownership stake, a controlling ownership stake, and then use that domestic subsidiary to make very large corporate donations. And again, the firewalls for foreign influence in our election kind of fade away because it's so unaccountable.
Well, thank you for calling in, Chris. Let's go next to Alder in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So, I'm kind of curious. All the talk I've heard so far kind of highlights how, you know, how powerful and how much money will actually be heading into politics. I'm wondering, are we kind of trying to close the barn door after the horses have left? Shouldn't we concentrate on increasing transparency instead of just banning donations all?
Yeah, I think we need to have a grown-up discussion around all the different ways to. I mean, I think the central problem here is that regular people don't have a voice, and fixing that problem could have a lot of remedies. I mean, what New York City has done just in recent elections, I think they've only done it for maybe one election or two elections, is provide a very generous matching fund so that small donors can participate at a greater rate than ever before. So when small donors in New York City elections provide a nominal donation, that is then has a multiplier effect. So now you have low-income or even middle-income individuals in New York City that when they get organized and start donating, they have just as much of a spending effect as some of the bigger donors in New York City elections. So, I mean, that's an interesting angle to this as well. So we do need more transparency so we know who's actually buying our politicians, which interest groups and individuals. But then we also need to empower small donors. So it's a mix of solutions, and unfortunately we aren't having that discussion on a national scale.
Well, Bernie Sanders sure raised it with a $27 donation. Do you think any other politician will try to go that route at a time when, I mean, we saw so much money flowing at the conventions, at the Democratic convention, there were parties for various politicians that were $33,000 apiece?
Well, you know, here's the kind of you know, a lot of folks said, "Oh, Bernie, why don't you run as independent? Why don't you do another? Why don't you run in a different way?" The reason we got to talk about this is because Bernie caught a groundswell and forced the media to discuss these issues for at least a few months. And you know, Rose, you cover it very closely, but you know, there are a number of other candidates who are discussing this constantly on the local level. A number of people running for Congress are talking about this. They're just not receiving any media attention. I mean, there are so many activists who are becoming obsessed with this issue because they see it as the prism from which you have to talk about every other issue. You can't talk about tax reform without talking about the influence of money in politics. You can't talk about climate change without the influence of money in politics.
Yep.
So you see a lot of activists, a lot of candidates talking about it. You just don't see a lot of media interest in the issue.
That's right. Li Fong is investigative journalist with The Intercept. Check out his four-part investigation about foreign corporate influence in presidential politics. As a result of the investigation, FEC Commissioner Ann Revell is calling for a ban on foreign money in politics. And if you have any questions or comments on this issue, we'd love to hear from you and how it's covered or not covered. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nick writes in, "Last week, the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force ruled San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee and Steve Kawa in violation of San Francisco's Sunshine Ordinance for failure to release not a single document showing Lee's and Kawa's direction, connection to, and writing of Lee's massive plan to rezone huge swaths of San Francisco's bonus density program. Could there be a foreign connection here that Mayor Lee does not want revealed in addition to the ones that you are discussing, Lee?"
I can't speak to that specific issue, but you know, San Francisco on paper has one of the best records request laws, the Sunshine Law, which is kind of like the Freedom of Information Act law on the federal level that allows citizens to request government documents. But, you know, this is not the first time I've heard an instance of the Sunshine Act not being followed to the T. I think in addition to having strong laws, you need a strong civic body that's constantly pressuring for enforcement of the law and that government officials are following it.
Well, thank you for that email, Nick. Stephen writes, "Will Donald Trump's reliance on free media have any effect on the perception that you need lots of money in TV ads to be competitive in future campaigns? Could a sane liberal candidate do the same thing?"
I don't know about the second part because it's, you know, the arbitrary distinction that's drawn by the producers and the owners of the broadcast media. But, you know, I think what the Donald Trump phenomenon requires is just a larger discussion of what do we mean by money in politics and power in politics. Do we just talk about the campaign ads that buy these 30-second ads, or do we talk about the large institutions in America and how they devote their resources? So one way, of course, is traditional money in politics, spending on super PACs. But when the big corporate media decides to give free airtime on one issue or one candidate and erase others, that's money in politics too. It's just, you know, we don't really have a vernacular for, like, talking about it, but I would consider that a money in politics issue when CNN decides to give tons of free coverage, when, you know, CBC or NBC and CBS provide basically no coverage of Bernie Sanders in 2015 during their nightly news programs and provide something like, you know, 70 and 60 minutes of Donald Trump. Someone makes those decisions, and is that money in politics? Maybe not in the traditional sense of the term, but it's certainly power in politics.
And isn't it interesting how MSNBC's Joe Scarborough all last year had this nice little phone call with Donald Trump?
Yes.
Donald's calling. Hey, Donald, how are you? I mean, it was unbelievable the amount of coverage they gave this guy with these softball questions. And now they've done a whole 180. Joe Scarborough wrote an op-ed recently, I think it was in the Washington Post, my connection just went down, talking about how dangerous Donald Trump is and how the Republicans need to do everything they can to make sure he doesn't win.
Well, you know, I was just in Southeast Asia for a vacation, and, you know, people talk about how bad the media is in places like the Philippines, and the national news media obsesses over which famous politician is dating another politician or something like that, this kind of infotainment tabloid coverage. But, you know, coming back to the States, it's not that different.
And Donald Trump did raise $80 million in the last election cycle. People were surprised that the number was so high.
Yeah, you know, he has a groundswell of small donors, but he also has campaign bundlers, you know, lobbyists and high-level political consultants who are collecting large checks on his behalf, and he hasn't disclosed any of their names.
None.
So, you know, that's a big problem for Trump. And, you know, all his talk mocking big donors and super PACs during the Republican primary has faded away as the Republican establishment has turned and is now setting up big money groups on his behalf. So, you know, again, people have in the media have noted that he's not spending much, especially this month in August. But this very kind of fancy Republican consulting firm has set up a major Republican super PAC, Rebuild America Now, and is spending tons of money on his behalf. So it's not like there's no money on the Donald Trump side.
Right. And is there anything else you can tell us about where his money's coming from? You have some construction firms. What else?
You know, we don't have a full picture because not all the disclosure reports have come out. But notably, Stanley Hubbard, the big broadcast media executive, and a few others who are connected to the Koch brothers, who at least publicly say that they won't support Donald Trump, have said that they will be backing Donald Trump's campaign. Carl Icahn, the big investment guy that has done business with Donald Trump in the past, said he'll put money in a super PAC. And notably, back to the Koch brothers, they say that they will not run ads explicitly backing Donald Trump, but there is word that their congressional ads will mention Hillary Clinton in the ads in a disparaging way. Hmm. So that's a big wink and nod.
And then Dark Money, and we've talked about this a lot, Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money. You're in that book, and you've been reporting on this for years. So Dark Money is basically super PACs can influence elections. They're not required to publicly disclose their donors. Has this gotten worse over the last 6 years?
Oh, it's certainly gotten worse. I mean, we had the last midterm election was the darkest election we've had since Watergate. You know, in 2014, you had dark money groups flood congressional races all throughout the country and help elect a Republican Senate, shifting the power balance here in this country. And we're seeing that again in a big way in congressional races and a little bit on the presidential race. Marco Rubio, we still don't know who most of his donors were, you know, so because he mostly relied on a dark money group. Again, and Jeb Bush, we obsess over his super PAC that raised so much money and spent. But, you know, I went to some of his fundraisers. I went to one here in San Francisco, someone that you know well, Ron Conway, I saw at his fundraiser. But Ron Conway's name never showed up in the disclosed super PAC. So my suspicion is that Ron Conway didn't want his name associated with Jeb Bush and gave to the dark money group.
And he's a venture capitalist in technology, and he's a big supporter of Mayor Ed Lee.
That's right.
And apparently Jeb Bush. What about Hillary Clinton and super PACs?
Well, Hillary Clinton has a fleet of her own super PACs, Priorities USA being the biggest one. But she has also done some very novel maneuvers to coordinate with super PACs. One of her other super PACs that does mostly opposition research, online communications. Famously, they said that they would help push back against Hillary Clinton trolls with their own troll army on social media. This is, of course, Correct the Record, and they openly coordinate. You know, one of the distinctions with super PACs is that at least officially they couldn't coordinate with the candidates they were supporting, but Hillary Clinton's super PAC, Correct the Record, openly coordinates with Hillary. And they say that they can do this because they don't do what's known as independent expenditures. But this is a quirk in the law that the Federal Election Commission really should look at. But because the Federal Election Commission is broken, mm-hmm. there are 3 Democratic and 3 Republican commissioners. And whenever there's anything in terms of a contentious issue, even a minor issue, they deadlock 3-3.
Is there anything that can happen to change that? Because the FEC is supposed to have oversight over all of this.
Well, 2 things. One, the FEC needs to be restructured. But number 2, and what could be more immediate, I mean, these are federal laws for the most part, for a lot of these election campaign laws. And although the FEC traditionally has jurisdiction and priority over these issues, the FBI and the DOJ could step in. They just don't, right? They've got the resources and they've got the manpower, but they don't have the will.
And Don McGahn, a recent Republican commissioner on the FEC, is now a lawyer for Donald Trump's presidential campaign?
That's right. From the get-go, Don McGahn has been advising Trump, and he's at a very fancy law firm, Jones Day. And he has, you know, before this, he was advising the Koch brothers. He was their main attorney when they had issues before the FEC. So, you know, all this talk about Donald Trump not being tied to the establishment, you know, there needs to be a big asterisk there. There are a number of elites in the establishment who have always backed Trump, and we see the worm turning just in the last month, many more.
It's such a good point, Lee, because for a year we had to hear people, even in the progressive media, say Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are the anti-establishment candidates. And yet look at Donald Trump's record.
Sure. Look at his record and just look at the reality that he has high-level media support. I mean, you can't get more elite than Jeff Zucker and some of these other broadcast executives who are close to Trump, who've given him business and who've promoted him relentlessly. Or CBS's chief, Les Moonves, making like $60 million a year. That's a little elite. I don't know.
And his economic team is anything but populist.
Sure. No, and he's given up a lot of these. I mean, they're not just elite, you know, kind of business donors and Wall Street executives. These folks believe in unfettered free trade. They support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this deal that Donald Trump supposedly opposes. The majority of his economic team that he announced, I believe, earlier this week or last, they're supporters of it. So there's a contradiction here that I think hasn't been pointed out.
And Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, speaking in favor of Donald Trump at the convention.
There you go.
Lee Fong is an investigative journalist with The Intercept. Check out his four-part investigation about foreign corporate influence in U.S. presidential politics. Oh, and Lee, just quickly, the FEC is calling for a ban on foreign money. Do you expect this to go anywhere?
I hope so.
We'll
but,
see.
You know, realistic, probably not.
All right. Well, be sure to follow Lee throughout the campaign. We'll definitely have you back in the coming months because he does excellent reporting on money and politics. Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Jour Call, we'll have a conversation about the growing influence private equity firms have on our daily lives. According to a New York Times investigation, since the 2008 financial crisis, private equity firms have expanded their influence by winning government contracts and shaping public policy. They now control water supplies, roads, garbage collection, and more. So who are the biggest players in the equity market? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Jour Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Producer, Matt Martin is executive producer.